Blog Talk Radio.
From the case files of God's Gumshoe, Case 606, codename Ichabod.
Hi, God's Gumshoe. It's me, Ichabod. I have another question. What do they mean when they talk about the Gospels? Thanks, Gumshoe. Keep up the good work. Ichabod.
Thank you, Ichabod. Well, as we've talked about, the Gospels generally is accepted that it is the first four books of the New Testament, something called the Good News. However, in reading the Gospels, we read in there that Jesus preached the Gospel. So the Gospels really refer to what it is that Jesus was teaching and what Jesus was saying. Now, we've already gone through the first three, which are called the Synoptic Gospels, and now we're at the fourth Gospel, John. It's very unlike the other three in sort of biographical details and the author's literary style. This is a glorious poetic book. John recounts some of the same events in the life and death of Jesus as the others do. But this book is more figurative and spiritual than the other three. It also contains critical differences, including variations on the basic fact of how many times Jesus visited Jerusalem during his life. Like Mark, John ignores Jesus' miraculous birth, and John is the only one to report Jesus' first miracle, in which he changed water into wine at the wedding feast. So John is the fourth book in our magical mystery tour of the Gospels. Complex and profound, it has been attributed to John, one of the disciples of Jesus, the closest one, in fact. This Gospel draws a different picture of Jesus' life and teachings, and leads scholars to detect a sort of an eyewitness account of the immediacy of everything. For more than 2,000 years, Christians accepted that John was written by one of these 12 disciples chosen by Jesus. But since the 19th century, the identity of John's author has generally heated controversy. While traditional scholars still believe that John was an apostle and an eyewitness to the events of this book, other biblical historians refute the idea, arguing that a Galilean fisherman could not have written the book's highly polished and poetic Greek. This fourth gospel explains the mystery of the person of Jesus, like other men, yet unlike other men, standing above them in a unique, solitary grandeur. John takes us behind the scenes of Jesus' earthly ministry, letting us see the eternal origin and divine nature of this man, who was more than just a man. He was eternally present with God, active in creating the world, the source of the moral and spiritual nature of man. Hence, when he became a man, he made known the eternal God whom no one has ever seen. Such is the story of John. As do the other evangelists, John records real events, but he goes beyond them in interpreting these events. He uses symbols from common experience, such as bread, water, light, life, shepherd, door, and contrasting images from the thought world of the time, such as light and darkness, truth, lies, love, hate, to make the meaning of Christ clear and gripping. After a magnificent prologue, he sets forth Jesus' life as the object of faith, depicts his conflict with unbelievers, and his fellowship with believers. Then, his death and his resurrection are taken up in chapters 18 and 20 and concludes with this grand epilogue in chapter 21. Who is this author? Well, tradition tells us that it is the Apostle John. Many scholars, however, suggest that the disciple John recorded his preachings just the same way that Mark did for Peter, that John had a disciple or a helper, an assistant. In any case, the historical basis of this gospel has been increasingly recognized. When it appeared, in and around 90 to 100 AD, it was immediately accepted as authentic and apostolic testimony to Jesus, written that men might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and thus have life in his name. So, let's step into John. Let's listen to his words. Let's listen to what those with a biblical worldview have to say about it. Then let's discuss this with our scholars, with the second voice of our witness program here, and then we'll listen to what the Urantia Papers have to say about this particular gospel and this particular man, the Apostle John. Here is Dr. Wright, Bishop of Durham, the Church of England. Dr. Wright?
The Gospel of John has been a difficult subject for historians to handle for these last couple of hundred years, because there's been an assumption out there that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are kind of the historical bit and John is the theological bit. Now, just as we now know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are every bit as much theological, I think it's time to start looking at John and saying, maybe there's more history there than met the eye. Now, in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a movement of British Johannine scholarship which was saying there is a lot more history in John than we'd supposed. But I don't think that movement really went far enough. What I think I've shown in my works, which are based on Matthew, Mark, and Luke particularly, is that actually the Jesus of history, reconstructed from Matthew, Mark, did believe that Israel's God was present and active in himself, did believe that he really was Israel's Messiah. Because you see, when we read in John Jesus saying, I'm the light of the world, I'm the bread of life, I'm this, I'm that, we have short-circuited the meaning of those phrases. We have thought that they meant, without remainder, I'm the second person of the Trinity. But actually, I think if you had been present with, say, Simon Bar Giora at the last stages of the Jewish war in 70 AD, if you'd been present with Bar Kokhba in 132 to 135, I think he'd have said, I'm the light, follow me and you won't walk in darkness anymore. I'll give you the bread of life. You come to me, you'll never be hungry again. This is Jewish messianic language. I don't think it means I am some supernatural being. You know, I think we've misread John like that. Now, I haven't done all the work to follow this through, but one other insight which I've struggled with sometimes, but I think is true. What we have in Matthew, Mark, and Luke comes out quite neat in chunks of about 10 or 14 or 15 verses, usually, some slightly longer. That's why it's so easy to find bits to read out in church. If you want a nice little chunk, it'll come away clean. And there's another bit, and there's another bit, with little connections between. It's very hard to do that with lots of John. Some of those discourses in John seem to go rambling round and round and round like this. I once saw a world-class actor do a performance of John's Gospel from memory, and he said at the beginning, he said, sooner or later in this performance, I'm going to forget where I am. He said, I've got a little copy here, and I will look at it. Sure enough, halfway through chapter 8, he just got a little bit lost, just checked it out, carried on, didn't happen again. And that's because I think John's Gospel has not been shaped by the church telling the story so often that it fell into an anecdote form, a nice easy thing, and this bit, so that it just made sense like that. I think John's Gospel grows out of the memory of an man who has been praying over this stuff again and again and again. I can't prove that, but it makes quite a lot of sense to me. And within that, of course, his life of prayer and preaching and devotion and holiness has colored the way he says it. But I think John's Gospel goes back, as John A.T. Robinson said, to source rather than to sources. And that when we look at that source, it really does turn out to be Jesus. As whoever wrote John chapter 21 says, we know that his witness is true. But I think in the process of discovering that truth, we may have to unthink some of the rather superficial ways that we have read those sayings of Jesus and to put them back into their first century Jewish context better than we've done. That's a whole task that I haven't really anything like completed myself, but maybe another generation will be required for it. After all, as you know, whoever wrote the bulk of John's Gospel seems to have died just before it finished. Half the main commentators on John this century died just before they finished it. Maybe I shall write half a commentary on John and somebody else will finish it.
Okay, now, let's just do that. Let's just finish this. So let's go to the Yale University, where Dr. Dale Martin, who's the head of the New Testament Studies Department, will help us to get a full understanding of the Apostle John and the Gospel of John.
We're going to continue with the lecture on the Gospel of John that I talked about. Now remember, the rubric under which today's lecture happens is not just the Gospel of John and not just the letters of John. As I've brought up several times, the method that I'm teaching you right now in this class is the historical critical method as it was developed in the 20th century in Europe and North America. This means that we're not reading these texts for just what the texts say about theology or even the early church or doctrine or ethics or something like that. We're trying to read the text in a way against the very intention of the text. We're taking the text as being something like a window that we can look through to try to construct, as best as we can guess at it, what kind of social context, what kind of political context, what kind of church, what kind of social groups these produced these texts and found them to be compelling, found them to be believable. So there are lots of other ways to read this. Obviously, the Gospel of John is very important for Christian doctrine. It's the most Christological of the Gospels. It has the highest form of Christology, that is the Christology that's the most divine rather than simply being human. And so it's very important for doctrine and for theology and for faith. But what I'm doing right now is just one particular way of reading, which is reading this text as a clue, as a series of clues and traces that we might use to reconstruct what we think was going on in the first century with the growth of Christianity. And I'm trying to show you by this that there are different kinds of Christianity that grew up in different places, different geographical settings, and different times. So what we call Johannine Christianity is what we're going to talk about today. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Somebody actually has memorized this. I'm so proud of you. I got me some good Sunday school people in the class, or at least somebody who's done the reading for the day. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him. God, what a philosophical-sounding term. Being. It screams to be capitalized, like Hegel or someone like that would do. Being. You sit around in your dorm room worried about being. What is the nature of being? What is the nature of existence? Yeah? No? If you do, you're a good philosopher. What has come into being? Now, that's also very philosophical. In traditional classical philosophy, from Plato on, being is one kind of thing, and coming into being is something else. Things that are truly, truly, truly being don't come into being, because that means at one time they were not. Man, this sounds so philosophical. And the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness did not overcome it. You skip down a bit. Verse 14. The Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen His glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. That sounds not only philosophical, but downright theological. No one has ever seen God. Good theological point, right? It is God the only Son. God the only Son. Have we heard anything like that kind of language so far in this course? God, the only Son. No, we haven't. That sounds like a Christian creed. It doesn't sound like Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It doesn't sound like Acts. It doesn't even sound like Thomas. We're in a different world with this gospel. This is not like anything we've seen so far. So from the very beginning of the Gospel of John, you should know you're in a different world from the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The style, for example. Over and over again, the style is repetitious. There are phrases and words that come up over and over again. Darkness and light, light and darkness. I already did some of that with the Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, without whom not one thing came into being. What has come into being? Come into being, repeated three times. Little clue, don't write your exegesis papers like this. This is not good American English writing style. You're supposed to vary your terminology, right? A little bit, and alter your terms. That's good English writing style. This, of course, is actually fairly good ancient Greek writing style. It's just that different writing styles are different. but it's also a writing style that we haven't seen so far. So there's this repetition of words. There are memorable sayings in the Gospel of John that you don't have in other places. There's a whole lot less action in the Gospel of John and a whole lot more talk. Just flip open the Gospel of John almost any place, and it'll start off with a scene, often a conflict scene, with Jesus in kind of a conversation with other people, but pretty quickly it'll go into a dialogue in which Jesus is saying something, the other person says something, go back and forth a bit, and then it goes even from a dialogue into Jesus just being chatty Cathy and just talking for paragraphs. We don't have any of this kind of stuff in the synoptics of Jesus just going off on tangents for paragraphs at a time and talking for a whole chapter sometimes. And that's what you get in the Gospel of John. There are some scenes in the Gospel of John where the characters look actually more lifelike than they do in the Synoptic Gospels. Have you noticed in the Synoptic Gospels, the characters sometimes are just a tax collector, a sinner, a Pharisee, a Syrophoenician woman, a centurion who had a slave? Most of the time they don't have a name. Most of the time they'd say one or two things to Jesus. One of the longest conversations with Jesus that we have with another character is precisely the Syrophoenician woman you've read about, where you remember she comes and says she wants her daughter to be healed, and she's not a Jew, and so Jesus says, it's not right to take bread from the children's mouths and throw it to the dogs, calling her a dog. And undeterred, she says, yes, but the dogs get to eat the crumbs from under the master's table. That's one of the longest dialogues that Jesus has with another person, not his disciple, in the Synoptic Gospels. Very different when we get to the Gospel of John. We have this scene we'll go to in a minute where Jesus has a whole chapter talking to Nicodemus. We're told who Nicodemus is, we're told a little bit about him, and then Jesus has a conversation with him. We have a whole scene in which Jesus is talking to this woman at the well, a Samaritan woman. We know more about this woman than we know about just about anybody else in the Synoptic Gospels. We know that she's had 7 husbands. How many people do we know that about? We know that, you know, she's a Samaritan. We know where she lives. We know that she goes out to draw water. So there are a lot of places in the Gospel of John where characters actually look much more lifelike and filled out than they have been in the Gospels that we've read so far. This lecture is going to focus on the Gospel of John. But as you've already figured out, one of the main themes of the course is how were the different forms of early Christianity different from one another? It wasn't just one movement. It's not like some new religion just sprang out of the earth or fell from heaven. So one of the themes of the course has been to look at the different kinds. And the Gospel of John and then the letters of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, which we'll talk about next time, are a wonderful example of this. In fact, if you look at the syllabus, today's lecture constitutes a certain shift in the syllabus. Because although I am talking about a gospel, and I have been talking about gospels, I put a little subheading under this week that's sort of like the spread of Christianity and how different Christian groups look different. We talked about that with the book of Acts last time. But this time what we're going to do is we're going to use Johannine Christianity, just one of those fancy scholarly words. Just refers to different kinds of John Christianity. So we've got the Gospel of John and we have the 3 letters of John. And they are similar enough, although it's quite debatable whether they're all written by the same person. We'll talk about that when we get to the letters of John. But they're similar enough in their writing style and in their terminology and in their theological themes that we believe that all 4 of these documents, the Gospel of John, 1st and 2nd and 3rd John, represent one form of early Christianity. And we're going to call that Johannine Christianity. Or some people might pronounce it Johannine Christianity. The same thing. So this lecture is going to focus on that. So let's first look at the narrative differences in the Gospel of John. I hope you noticed this when you were reading through it. First, there's this prologue that I started reading at the very beginning of the lecture. It has several major themes that will occur throughout the Gospel. And it's just packed into this prologue. There's first, Jesus' pre-existence. In no other Gospel do we get the idea that Jesus existed before his birth. That's counterintuitive to a lot of us, because whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, You're used to thinking about Jesus as an eternal divine being who becomes incarnate as a human being, but always existed. That's not in the other Gospels, if you notice. But it's definitely here in the Gospel of John. So we get the pre-existence of Jesus and his divinity right there in the prologue. You get this theme of light. You get this theme of light and darkness. Jesus comes from light. He comes into darkness. The darkness doesn't receive him. He brings light to his followers. There's the coming into the world. The world is not simply the physical world that you and I know. It's the cosmos, the Greek word, where we get the word cosmology. All the universe. So Jesus comes into the cosmos. So the cosmos as a dark enemy place in which Jesus invades it, in a sense, is one of the major themes of the Gospels that you get right here in the prologue. The world is a place of enmity. The world hates Jesus. The world hates the disciples. The world hates you if you're a follower of Jesus. Birth from God. So there's this idea that people are born from God. Son and father linkage. Over and over again, God is Jesus' father in the Gospel of John. That's true in some of the other Gospels, but it's just much more so in the Gospel of John. John the Baptist, as the lesser of the two, is introduced right in the prologue. We don't take a while to get to John. We have John the Baptist right in verse 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe in him. He himself was not the light. This guy wants you to know from the very beginning, John the Baptist is not Jesus' equal. He's a secondary witness. Just so you don't get confused. There's the idea that the law comes from Moses, but grace and truth come from Jesus. And there's this emphasis on seeing and knowing. As we'll talk about later when I hit some of the major themes of the gospel, seeing and knowing are two definite themes for the Gospel of John, and it's all right there wrapped up in the prologue to the Gospel. So that John is different from anything else because in this very, very elaborately constructed, poetic-sounding, almost philosophical-sounding prologue, you get lots of the major themes of the Gospel just laid out for you. So that's a narrative difference. Another major narrative difference is the relationship of Jesus and John the Baptist. In the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus' ministry does not begin until the arrest of John. Did you notice this? Jesus goes to John the Baptist to be baptized, and it looks like Jesus, in a sense, is almost a disciple of John, although the gospel writers try not to tell it that way. But Jesus doesn't start his own preaching ministry and his own healing ministry until the ministry of John the Baptist is over. So for the Synoptic Gospels, John the Baptist ministry comes here, John the Baptist ministry stops, Jesus starts. Very clear. In the Gospel of John, that's not the way it is. Their two ministries overlap each other. So, for example, sometimes John the Baptist is baptizing, and the Gospel of John tells us that Jesus and his disciples are baptizing in another part of the Jordan. What? We don't hear anything like that in the other Gospels. Jesus and his disciples over here in another part of the Jordan baptizing their disciples while John is baptizing his disciples. And then sometimes John's disciples leave John and go over and join Jesus. And then there's some discussions between them. Sometimes John the Baptist's disciples come and ask Jesus' disciples, well, you know, what does your master do about this or this or that? So there's an overlap of the two ministries that you get in the Gospel of John, and you don't get at all in the other Gospels. Another big difference, Judea and Galilee. If all you had were the first three Gospels, the ideas you'd have was that Jesus' entire ministry took place basically in Galilee until the last part of his life. And then he journeys to Jerusalem, and according to the Gospels, he's only basically in Jerusalem for 1 week, and then he's crucified. That's not the way it is in the Gospel of John. In fact, did any of you notice, where is the cleansing of the temple incident in the Synoptic Gospels? When does it happen? When does the cleansing of the temple incident happen in Matthew, Mark, and Luke? All three of them. At the end, right on like maybe Wednesday, before he's executed. It happens the last week of his life, right before he is arrested. In fact, the Gospels present that as maybe one of the reasons that he is arrested. When does it happen in the Gospel of John? Okay, it happens at the very beginning of the Gospel. I couldn't remember exactly what chapter, but that's good. So the cleansing of the temple happens at the beginning of the Gospel of John, not the end, like in the others. The length of Jesus' ministry. In the Synoptic Gospels, if all you have was Synoptic Gospels, it would look like the ministry of Jesus probably lasted maybe a year. Not much more than that. There's just no indication of how long it takes. But he goes to Jerusalem only one time for the Passover, and that's at the end of his life. In the Gospel of John, there are three different mentions of Passovers. There's the Passover in chapter 2, verse 13. This is when he goes up to Jerusalem and cleanses the temple there. There's another Passover mentioned in chapter 6, verse 4. And there's another Passover mentioned in 13, verse 1. That is the Passover that's at the end of his life when he's arrested. So there's three Passovers that occur in Jesus' ministry according to the Gospel of John. Have you ever heard the tradition that Jesus was 30 years old when he started his ministry, and his ministry lasted 3 years, so he would have been dead at 33? You may have heard that. Do you know how people got that tradition? It's not in the Bible anywhere. They get the 30-year-old idea from reading some passages in Luke and the idea of when he started his ministry. They get the 3 years from reading the Gospel of John. So notice how they've taken one little detail about Jesus' life from Luke, a different detail from John. They combined them together to give you the tradition. But no gospel actually has that teaching in it. Christians have pulled these gospel, the details from the gospels together. That's because John's the only one that indicates that according to his reckoning, Jesus' ministry covered at least three Passovers. The other gospels don't have that. Jesus' parents and hometown. According to Matthew, Jesus' family is simply from Bethlehem. That's where they start off. That's where they end up. So Jesus' family is from Bethlehem. Jesus later goes to Galilee. According to the Gospel of Luke, Jesus' family is from Galilee. They go to Bethlehem only for the census. And then a month or so after the birth, they go back to Galilee. So we've got differences right there. Matthew simply has Jesus' family from Judea in the beginning, and they end up moving to Galilee after they go to Egypt. Luke has them from Galilee, go to Judea, go back to Galilee. John doesn't have anything about this Bethlehem birth. In fact, he has, in chapter 7, verse 31, people say, how can you be the Messiah? Who says the Messiah is supposed to come from Galilee? The Messiah is not supposed to come from Galilee. The Messiah is supposed to come from Bethlehem. And the writer of Gospel of John, wouldn't this be a great time if he could just say, ah, these stupid Jews, they don't know that Jesus actually was born in Bethlehem, and therefore he is from Judea. He doesn't say anything like that. He just allows the reader, you the reader, to believe that, yeah, Jesus really was from Galilee, and you know what? That doesn't matter. They must have gotten it wrong. They must not have thought that the Messiah could actually come from Galilee, but he can't. So again, the Gospel of John, different in its narrative structure. The Last Supper. The Last Supper in the Synoptic Gospels is a Passover meal. The Last Supper in John is not a Passover meal. In fact, also, the Last Supper is not the institution of the Eucharist in John. In Christian churches, we observe the Mass or the Eucharist, and we say, Jesus established this in his Last Supper with his disciples. Do this in memory of me. That goes back to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The Gospel of John doesn't have that. There's no place in the Gospel of John where Jesus initiates the Last Supper. He doesn't take the cup, he doesn't take the blood, and say, do this in memory of me. What happens at the Last Supper in the Gospel of John? He has a foot washing. There's a foot washing ceremony. Notice again what Christian tradition has done here. Any of you know what Maundy Thursday means in Christian churches? Maundy Thursday refers to the Thursday before Good Friday, which is the Friday before Easter. And on Good Friday, according to the tradition, Jesus was executed. The Thursday night before is when he has the Last Supper with his disciples. Now, in many Christian churches, on the Thursday before Easter, not only will they have the Eucharist service or a communion service, but they'll also have a foot washing service. At the church where I go, the different priests will actually get down on their hands and knees and put towels around themselves and wash the feet of anybody in the church who comes forward on Thursday night before Easter. They're doing that in imitation of Jesus' foot washing of his disciples at the Last Supper in John. But notice what we've done here. Again, Christians have combined the Last Supper and the Eucharist establishment from the Synoptic Gospels with the foot washing service from the Gospel of John, and they put them together. But they weren't together in our Bible. They were in two separate documents. The arrest is also very different in the Synoptic Gospels. In the Synoptic Gospels, they come to arrest Jesus, and they just arrest him, and there's a few things. In the Gospel of John, there's this funny scene. It's actually very humorous, where they come up with the swords and the clubs, you know, it's the middle of the night in the garden, and they come up to Jesus, and Jesus says, "Who are you looking for?" And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus says, "I am he," and they all fall over on the ground. It's like an Indiana Jones thing. They, you know, the power of him saying this knocks them all over. And they get up and do it again, and they all fall over again. The whole scene of the arrest of Jesus is very different in the Gospel of John. At his trial, in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus says almost nothing. Some of the Synoptics say he said nothing. Others of the Synoptics say he said something. But he's very, very quiet. In the Gospel of John, he just carries on this whole philosophical discussion with Pilate about what is truth. He just keeps talking and talking. Very different scene. On the crucifixion, there's some differences. Remember, I'm here rehearsing just narrative differences between the first three Gospels and John. These are places where just the story is different in its details. According to the first three Gospels, the crucifixion takes place on the first day of Passover. The Thursday night supper, remember, in Jewish calendar reckoning, a day begins at sundown. So on sundown of Thursday night, that's the beginning of Friday. And in the Synoptic Gospels, that's the beginning of the Passover. So they wait till sundown, and they have the Passover meal Thursday night. And that's the beginning of Friday, the first day of Passover. And it's on the Friday, the first day of Passover, that Jesus is actually executed. That's not the way it is in the Gospel of John. Read the execution narrative in the Gospel of John. According to the Gospel of John, Jesus is not crucified on the first day of Passover. He's crucified on the day before Passover. And how do we know that? Because it says when they were crucifying him was the same time they were slaughtering the lambs in the temple. Notice, it's a wonderful little symbolism, right? Right when Jesus is being slaughtered, the lambs for the Passover meal are being slaughtered. Because what you'd do, of course, if you were a Jew in Jerusalem, you'd take your lamb to the priests on Thursday, you'd have them slaughter it, pour out the blood. They'd take a little bit of it. Then you take it back home to your family or to the hotel where you're staying or to the picnic ground where you're staying, and you cook your lamb, and that's where you have the Passover meal. So according to the Gospel of John, Jesus is executed at the same time that they're slaughtering the lambs, which means he's not executed on the day of Passover, but the day before Passover. Completely different. And the last big narrative difference with the Gospel of John from the Synoptics is this guy named the Beloved Disciple. Who the hell is the Beloved Disciple? We don't know who he is. According to Dan Brown and Da Vinci Code, right. According to Da Vinci Code, the Beloved Disciple is actually a girl, Mary Magdalene. I guess it's because he couldn't believe that Jesus could be, you know, attracted to a guy. So he had to invent a girl to be the Beloved Disciple. Heterosexist, as, you know, modern novelists are. No, the Beloved Disciple is a man, and we don't even know who he is. He's Jesus' favorite disciple in the Gospel of John. This character doesn't exist in the other Gospels. He's just not there. Now, tradition has said, who is the Beloved Disciple? Well, it's the John, son of Zebedee, younger brother of James, son of Zebedee. And if you go to the art gallery, which you will later in the semester, we're all going to take a tour of the Yale Art Gallery, you'll see that when John, son of Zebedee, is depicted in art, he's always depicted as a young man without a beard, very beautiful, almost feminine looking, because he's sort of representing the boy that Jesus loved. Well, we don't know that it was John. The Gospel of John doesn't tell us it was John. It just tells us it's the Beloved Disciple. So most scholars are just willing to say, whoever this Beloved Disciple was, and maybe it was just a figment of the literary pretensions of this writer. Maybe there was no historical Beloved Disciple. We don't know. But he's a strong character in this gospel, and he doesn't appear anyplace else but in this gospel. Notice, in all those ways, the Gospel of John is very different from the other three gospels. That in itself makes it really interesting to study. It opens up a window for us of an entirely different kind of early Christianity than we would have if we didn't have this gospel. So it's really wonderful. Okay, some major Johannine themes. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because if you just take a concordance and look up these terms, you can look at all the different places. First, notice that some of these main themes, I've already mentioned some of them when I was talking about the prologue, these main themes occur over and over and over again like the ringing of bells in the Gospel of John. Every once in a while you'll see one in one chapter, and then you might not hear it to the next chapter, a few chapters later, but they'll just keep coming up. So this author hits you over the head several times throughout the Gospel with the same themes coming back at you. One of them is the descending and ascending Redeemer figure. Jesus is the one who came down from above, who's going up. Look at 151. 151, and he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." So the angels are ascending. Look at 313. "No one has ascended into heaven except the one who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Look at 331. "The one who comes from above is above all. The one who is of the earth belongs to the earth and speaks about earthly things. The one who comes from heaven is above all." And I could go on. 132, 638, 641, 658, 2017. Just look up this coming and rising and look up these words in a concordance and you'll find they recur over and over in the Gospel of John. Very similar to that one is the theme of being lifted up. So Jesus in 314, in 1232, in 828. You don't need to remember these numbers because you can look at a concordance, you can read this, and you can just mark out in the margins of your Bible whenever you see this idea. In all of those, Jesus is the one who will be lifted up. And this is a puzzle. One of the things we'll find is the Gospel of John likes puzzles. He likes riddles. So what does this mean when Jesus talks about the Son of Man being lifted up? Does it mean his ascension into heaven? Does it mean his resurrection from the dead? Does it mean his being put on a cross? Because when you nailed somebody on a cross, you did it on the ground and then you put them up like this. So does the lifting up of the Son of Man refer to his crucifixion? Or his resurrection? Or his ascension? Going back to the Father? It's a puzzle. We're never told exactly. And that's one of the wonderful things about this text is that it plays with you all the time. It wants you to wonder about what's being meant here. So that lifted up is one of the themes that goes along with this going up and coming down. And then another part of that theme, see these themes get complicated, is when Jesus says, "Everyone who comes to me when I'm lifted up, I will lift up." So Jesus says, he will lift up people who are his disciples. So this going up and coming down is all the way through the Gospels. That's one of the main themes. I mentioned seeing. Okay, we're going to run like bunnies through the text. 1:18. "No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known." Oh, now see, I should have told you. Knowing is another theme there. We got two themes right in the same verse. Seeing and knowing. And the relationship between seeing and knowing in the Gospel of John is also difficult. It's not always clear. Do you know by seeing? Or does seeing lead to an inadequate form of knowing? These are big exegetical problems that the Gospel of John poses, and scholars argue about. Look at 1:34. "And I myself have seen and have testified that this is the Son of God." Okay, I have seen. Look at 1:39. "He came to them, come and see. They came and saw where he was staying." In other words, just look in the concordance for every time you find the word see, saw, seeing. And you'll just find it over and over again. Chapter 3, verse 3, chapter 3, verse 11, chapter 3, verse 32, chapter 3, verse 36. Several right there in chapter 3, etc., etc., etc. And again, it's always a little bit difficult to figure out, do you have to see to have faith in the Gospel of John? Or, because it sounds like one place toward the end of the Gospel, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who believe without seeing." He says to Thomas, "Blessed are you. You saw, and so you believe, so that's okay. Blessed are those who have not seen and believe." So is seeing an inadequate form of faith? Is it better to have faith without seeing, or is seeing necessary for faith? The problem. I already mentioned knowing, but I could do the same kind of thing. chapter 1, verse 18, chapter 8, verse 55, chapter 14, verse 17, over and over again. Where Jesus came from and where Jesus is going is a major theme. With the Jews, often he'll say, you can't go where I'm going. And they say, what is he talking about going? Is he going to go out to the Greeks and preach to the Greeks? Is he going to go back to Galilee? What is he about going? So people are always misunderstanding this. And then one of the other points is signs. What are signs in the Gospel of John? Notice, the Gospel of John has other differences that I haven't even mentioned. For example, remember in the Synoptic Gospels, there are lots of exorcisms of demons. Jesus is going around a lot casting out demons from people. And the demons even confess them. Do you know, there's not one exorcism in the Gospel of John. Jesus is not an exorcist in the Gospel of John, as he is in the other three Gospels. Why is that? Obviously, this writer knew that there were stories circulating around that Jesus cast out demons. Why does he not have Jesus doing any casting out of demons in his Gospel? I don't know. There's probably a dissertation there somewhere, if you can find an answer. Look at 2:11. So one of the things is that in the other Gospels, they talk about Jesus' miracles, his healing, but a term preferred by this Gospel writer is sign. He talks about the things Jesus did as signs. Now, there's not a lot of them. Jesus doesn't do a whole lot of miracles in the Gospel of John. He does some big, important ones that become famous. For example, turning water into wine, which is, of course, every college student's favorite miracle of Jesus. If only he had turned it into beer, that might have been a little bit better, right? But Jesus is famous for turning water into wine, one of his major miracles. It's only in the Gospel of John. It's not in the other Gospels. So some of Jesus' famous miracles are in the Gospel of John, but they're not called miracles in John. They're called signs. So look at 2:11. Jesus did this. The first of his signs, this is the turning the water into the wine, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. Notice, the first of his signs. Let's look over a little bit. 4:54. Now this was the second sign that Jesus did after coming from Judea to Galilee. The second sign. This has actually led some scholars to say that one of the sources this writer may have had is a signs book. A collection of signs that is miracles that Jesus did. But notice, they're not just a miracle that Jesus does and then casts off. I think that the author uses the term sign because most of the time you can actually do an exegesis of these signs narratives and they have some kind of symbolic meaning. So the signs in Gospel of John are not just miracles to prove Jesus' power. They seem to have some kind of theological or symbolic meaning embedded into them also. So the signs, again, is one of the major themes of the Gospel of John. But one of the most important things that drives the Gospel of John is sectarianism. What do I mean by sectarianism? According to sociology of religion, a sect, it's not necessarily just an insult. In other words, you don't just say, oh, you're just a member of some crazy little sect out there handling snakes or doing other kinds of things. A sect is a sociological term that refers to any group, whether it's religious or not, although we usually tend to use this in religious context, that considers itself very well cut off from the rest of society. So, for example, I grew up in a very, very sectarian, fundamentalist church in Texas. By sectarian, I mean that we basically believe that we in my church were the only ones going to heaven. So, in fact, we would call each other brother or sister. And you wouldn't even call a Baptist. I mean, we thought the Southern Baptists were going to hell. You know, that's how much we were the only ones. There was nobody who was right like we were right. So you'd call each other brother. Brother Lamar. All the old men in the church especially were called brother. But you wouldn't call people brother who were outside that group. So we were the only Christians. You had to be in our group. In fact, people would even talk about, you know, something like if you brought somebody to church as a visitor, somebody might come up to you and say, well, is she a member of the church? They didn't need to say our church or our denomination. It was just the church. Because the church meant our church. So this, what made this group a sectarian group was we had very firm boundaries. There were debates about whether it was okay to marry outside of that boundary. Could you actually marry a Methodist? Oh, God, no. And God help you, a Roman Catholic. So the stronger the walls, the stronger the walls between your group and outsiders, the more sectarian your social group is. John's church seems to be a very sectarian group. And that's one of the things people, why does he talk so much about dark and light? These are stark divisions, insiders, outsiders, up, below. They're children of light and children of darkness. They're children of God and children of Satan. There's no in between. There's no gray area. You're either in or you're out. So scholars define this by talking about Johannine sectarianism, the insider-outsider division. And we're going to look at one place where that comes up. Look at chapter 9. I'm going to spend a little more time with this chapter because some scholars have used this to say what's going on in the Gospel of John. So get chapter 9. Get your Bibles out. You know, I may lie to you. This is a story about Jesus healing a man born blind. So I'm going to skip around to it. But first he heals him, and then 9 verse 10, they kept saying to him, that is the surrounders, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' Then I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" Notice this. Where is he? How do your eyes open? And he says, "I do not know. No, 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 no. I now see." Where is he? They brought him to the Pharisees, the man who had thrown him around. Now it was the Sabbath day. Now wait a minute. This is verse 13 for crying out loud. We've been 12 verses into this chapter, into this story, and only at verse 13 are we told that it's the Sabbath day. Why not? Why is that? Well, because apparently what started out as a simple healing story, this author has decided to turn into a conflict story. Have you noticed that in a lot of the stories of the Gospels, some stories just seem to be straightforward miracle stories. Other stories seem to be nature miracles, like not just healings, but power over nature. And then there are lots of stories that are conflict stories. That is, you're told that someone was healed, but the real important part of the story was not necessarily just that they were healed, but that they were healed on the Sabbath, and that starts a conflict between Jesus and other Jews about what's permitted to do on the Sabbath. By the time you get to verse 13, what started out as simply a healing story, although it may have had symbolic meaning, because the man's blind and he comes to see, and those are big, important themes for Gospel of John, now it becomes a conflict story over the Sabbath. So he tells the story again to the Pharisees in verse 17. So they said again to the blind man, this is the Pharisees, "What do you say about him? It was your eyes he opened." He said, "He is a prophet." Okay, so that's important. The Jews did not believe, this is verse 18, that he had been born blind and they received his sight, until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked him, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he see?" His parents said, We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. We do not know how it is that he now sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he'll speak for himself." His parents said this. This is the narrator speaking now. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. Now, wait a minute. All the people in this story are Jews. Jesus is a Jew. The blind man's a Jew. His parents are Jews. They're all Jews. Why are we talking about some people being afraid of the Jew? For the Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Now, I hate to tell you folks, but that's just outright anachronistic. There was no movement going on during the life of Jesus where anybody that confessed anybody to be a synagogue would be Jesus to be the Messiah would be excommunicated from the synagogue. That just didn't happen. There were all kinds of people who thought the Messiah was around. There were debates about this. But you didn't have any synagogue rulers going around saying, "Well, we're going to make a rule." Anybody who claims that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah will be excommunicated, will take their union card away from them. They can't come to High Holy Days. We will return their dues. It just wasn't going on. Now, it may have been going on decades later when this guy wrote the gospel, you see. So what's, now, we'll keep reading. What's going on here, of course, is what you believe about Jesus the Messiah has to do with whether you will be allowed to stay in the synagogue. If you take Jesus to be just a prophet, you might be allowed to stay. If you confess that he's the Messiah, you'll be kicked out of the synagogue. That's the basic conflict of the story. So we keep reading, and they go into more and more conflict. Look at verse 30. Then the man answered, they're basically saying, look, we know Moses. This guy can't be the Messiah. He must be wrong. The man answered, here is an astonishing thing. This is the man born blind who now sees. You do not know where he comes from. And yet he opened my eyes. I see. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but he does listen to one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us? And they drove him out. They kicked him out of the synagogue. Jesus heard that they had driven him out, and when he found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir? Tell me so that I might believe in him. Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Jesus said, and this is how the story ends, okay? So this must be important. I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see. Now is Jesus still talking just about blind people? No. We can see that the whole story was an allegory now. And those who do see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, surely we're not blind, are we? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would not have sinned. But now that you say we see, your sin remains. Some scholars have pointed out that what's going on with this chapter, chapter 9 in John, is a wonderful way to see how the writer himself has taken what may have been a simple miracle story that he got from tradition about Jesus healing a blind man. And he does a couple of things with it. For one thing, he pulls up to the surface these themes about blindness and seeing and coming from God. And this all plays into the identity of Jesus as the Messiah. And then he tells the story like the blind man is sort of like someone who comes to faith in Jesus as the Messiah. And he recognizes. But sure enough, if he really confesses that, he's going to be thrown out of the synagogue. And so he leaves the synagogue and he joins up with Jesus. He's thrown out of the synagogue, he becomes a disciple of Jesus. In other words, allegorically speaking, he has to leave the synagogue and therefore he becomes a member of John's church. There are other people who suspect that Jesus may well be the Messiah. They want to confess him, and they don't do so because they're afraid about being excommunicated from the synagogue. Notice how this story has become an allegory for what's going on in the time of the writing of the piece itself. The gospel writer is telling a story about a blind man, but he's also telling a story about the conflict that his church is having with the synagogue in the neighborhood. And the main thing that's going on here also is that Jesus is the one who brings about this division that takes place. What's the main focus of the division? Christology. Remember I talked last time about different Christologies? What Christology is what do you believe about the nature of Jesus Christ? Is he just human? Is he God? Is he some of both? Is he a prophet? Is he only a prophet? Is he a moral teacher? Is he only a moral teacher? Is he the Son of God? Is he equal to God the Father? All these are options. And the first several hundred years of Christianity is all wrapped up in fights over which of the many different options you have for what you believe about Jesus is going to end up being the right one. What's going to end up as orthodoxy? The Gospel of John is a wonderful place to see this very thing starting out. So look at chapter 5, verse 19. Yeah, that's right. Let's go look at 5:19. I'm going to back up in a minute and go back to some other dialogues. Don't worry, I'll finish on time today, but we will probably take up again some of the Gospel of John next time before we talk about the letters of John. Chapter 5, verse 19. Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and he will show him greater works than these, so that you will be astonished. Indeed, just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whomever he wishes. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, so that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Anyone who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Verily, truly, I tell you, anyone who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come unto judgment, but has passed from death to life." Look at 5:18, right before that. For this reason the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father. Now that's so far what you've gotten in the narrative, but notice what the author adds right after that. The next very phrase. Thereby making himself equal to God. Is every son always equal to a father? Go like this. No. All sons are not equal to all fathers. The gospel writer is editorializing. Because this is what he believes. He believes that not only is Jesus God's Son, in some kind of derivative sense, he believes that by saying that Jesus is God's Son, he's actually equal to God the Father. Look at 8:58. We're going to come back and talk about chapter 8 next time. Chapter 8 is one of these classic scenes in the Gospel of John, which start out with Jesus just talking to someone in what seems to be a cordial and relatively peaceful mood. And then as the conversation goes on, things get more and more heated. And people accuse Jesus of things, but Jesus is just as bad. He accuses people of stuff all the time. Ridiculous stuff sometimes. Like they're children of Satan. And the whole thing ends up with this big division, and everybody's starting to throw things at each other. And then the next chapter will start, and you'll see them talking again, and again, it comes down to a big division. So this is the end of chapter 8, which is one of these scenes of a discussion turning into a fight, turning into a brawl, turning into a division. And where does it end? Verse 58, chapter 8, Jesus said to them, "Very truly, I tell you, before Abraham was, I am." So they picked up stones to throw at him. Isn't that interesting? All he has to say is, "I am." Why is that so much of a problem? Where does "I am" come from? Yes. That's the declaration of what God is when God says, "I am," to whom and where in the Bible? Moses in front of the burning bush. Exactly. The very name of God, which those of us who are non-Jewish, we used to say is Yahweh. There are only four letters, right, in Hebrew. And those four letters don't have vowels attached to them. So we're not really sure how to pronounce them. In your English Bible, they're usually translated by Lord in small caps. Whenever you see Lord in small caps in your English translation of the Hebrew Bible, that means that the tetragrammaton, the four letters of God's name, are in the Hebrew. But according to pious Jewish usage, you never pronounce those. So you would say something like the Lord as a substitute. And that's the way in the Greek Bible it does. Since the Greek Bible didn't know what the name was, it just would say Adonai or the Lord or something like that. And so we'd use that in English translation. But the scholars think that perhaps the best translation for those four letters as they occur in Exodus is beingness or I am. Notice what Jesus is saying. He's claiming to be the one who spoke to Moses out of the bush. That's radical. That's way more radical than anything we've seen in the other Gospels. Jesus could be the Son of God and still not be God. Jesus could be the Son of the Father and still not be equal to the Father. Jesus could be the Messiah and still not be divine. And Jesus could be even the Messiah and divine and still not be I am. In the Gospel of John, nuh-uh. Jesus is I am. He's the one who spoke to Moses. It's no wonder that the Jews tried to stone him. We'll talk about that further next time.
Now, to complete our picture of the Gospel of John and then the Apostle John, we're going to go to the Urantia Papers, this collection of papers called the Urantia Papers in the Urantia book. We're going to go first to paper 121, section 8, which talks about the gospel and how it was prepared. Then we're going to go to paper 139, section 4, that talks about John Zebedee, the apostle of Jesus, and gives us some very important background information to this apostle, the writer of the Gospel of John. Listen to this. This is really something else.
4. The Gospel of John. The Gospel according to John relates much of Jesus' work in Judea and around Jerusalem, which is not contained in the other records. This is the so-called Gospel according to John, the son of Zebedee, and though John did not write it, he did inspire it. Since its first writing, it has several times been edited to make it appear to have been written by John himself. When this record was made, John had the other Gospels, and he saw that much had been omitted. Accordingly, in the year AD 101, he encouraged his associate Nathan, a Greek Jew from Caesarea, to begin the writing. John supplied his material from memory and by reference to the three records already in existence. He had no written records of his own. The epistle known as 1 John was written by John himself as a covering letter for the work which Nathan executed under his direction. All these writers presented honest pictures of Jesus as they saw, remembered, or had learned of him, and as their concepts of these distant events were affected by their subsequent espousal of Paul's theology of Christianity. And these records, imperfect as they are, have been sufficient to change the course of the history of Urantia for almost 2,000 years. 4. John Zebedee. When he became an apostle, John was 24 years old and was the youngest of the 12. He was unmarried and lived with his parents at Bethsaida. He was a fisherman and worked with his brother James in partnership with Andrew and Peter. Both before and after becoming an apostle, John functioned as the personal agent of Jesus in dealing with the Master's family, and he continued to bear this responsibility as long as Mary, the mother of Jesus, lived. Since John was the youngest of the 12, and so closely associated with Jesus in his family affairs, he was very dear to the Master, but it cannot be truthfully said that he was the disciple whom Jesus loved. You would hardly suspect such a magnanimous personality as Jesus to be guilty of showing favoritism, of loving one of his apostles more than the others. The fact that John was one of the three personal aides of Jesus lent further color to this mistaken idea, not to mention that John, along with his brother James, had known Jesus longer than the others. Peter, James, and John were assigned as personal aides to Jesus soon after they became apostles. Shortly after the selection of the 12, and at the time Jesus appointed Andrew to act as director of the group, he said to him, "And now I desire that you assign two or three of your associates to be with me and remain by my side to comfort me and to minister to my daily needs." And Andrew thought best to select for this special duty the next three first chosen apostles. He would have liked to volunteer for such a blessed service himself, but the Master had already given him his commission. So he immediately directed that Peter, James, and John attach themselves to Jesus. John Zebedee had many lovely traits of character, but one which was not so lovely was his inordinate, but usually well-concealed, conceit. His long association with Jesus made many and great changes in his character. This conceit was greatly lessened, but after growing old and becoming more or less childish, this self-esteem reappeared to a certain extent, so that, when engaged in directing Nathan in the writing of the Gospel which now bears his name, the aged apostle did not hesitate repeatedly to refer to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. In view of the fact that John came nearer to being the chum of Jesus than any other earth mortal, that he was his chosen personal representative in so many matters, it is not strange that he should have come to regard himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, since he most certainly knew he was the disciple whom Jesus so frequently trusted. The strongest trait in John's character was his dependability. He was prompt and courageous, faithful and devoted. His greatest weakness was this characteristic conceit. He was the youngest member of his father's family and the youngest of the apostolic group. Perhaps he was just a bit spoiled. Maybe he had been humored slightly too much. But the John of after years was a very different type of person than the self-admiring and arbitrary young man who joined the ranks of Jesus' apostles when he was 24. Those characteristics of Jesus which John most appreciated were the Master's love and unselfishness. These traits made such an impression on him that his whole subsequent life became dominated by the sentiment of love and brotherly devotion. He talked about love and wrote about love. This son of thunder became the apostle of love. And at Ephesus, when the aged bishop was no longer able to stand in the pulpit and preach, but had to be carried to church in a chair, and when at the close of the service he was asked to say a few words to the believers, for years his only utterance was, "My little children, love one another." John was a man of few words, except when his temper was aroused. He thought much, but said little. As he grew older, his temper became more subdued, better controlled, but he never overcame his disinclination to talk. He never fully mastered this reticence, but he was gifted with a remarkable and creative imagination. There was another side to John that one would not expect to find in this quiet and introspective type. He was somewhat bigoted and inordinately intolerant. In this respect, he and James were much alike. They both wanted to call down fire from heaven on the heads of the disrespectful Samaritans. When John encountered some strangers teaching in Jesus' name, he promptly forbade them. But he was not the only one of the 12 who was tainted with this kind of self-esteem and superiority consciousness. John's life was tremendously influenced by the sight of Jesus' going about without a home, as he knew how faithfully he had made provision for the care of his mother and family. John also deeply sympathized with Jesus because of his family's failure to understand him, being aware that they were gradually withdrawing from him. This entire situation, together with Jesus' ever deferring his slightest wish to the will of the Father in heaven, and his daily life of implicit trust, made such a profound impression on John that it produced marked and permanent changes in his character, changes which manifested themselves throughout his entire subsequent life. John had a cool and daring courage which few of the other apostles possessed. He was the one apostle who followed right along with Jesus the night of his arrest and dared to accompany his master into the very jaws of death. He was present and near at hand right up to the last earthly hour and was found faithfully carrying out his trust with regard to Jesus' mother and ready to receive such additional instructions as might be given during the last moments of the master's mortal existence. One thing is certain, John was thoroughly dependable. John usually sat on Jesus' right hand when the 12 were at meat. He was the first of the 12 really and fully to believe in the resurrection, and he was the first to recognize the Master when he came to them on the seashore after his resurrection. This son of Zebedee was very closely associated with Peter in the early activities of the Christian movement, becoming one of the chief supporters of the Jerusalem church. He was the right-hand support of Peter on the day of Pentecost. Several years after the martyrdom of James, John married his brother's widow. The last 20 years of his life, he was cared for by a loving granddaughter. John was in prison several times and was banished to the Isle of Patmos for a period of 4 years until another emperor came to power in Rome. Had not John been tactful and sagacious, he would undoubtedly have been killed, as was his more outspoken brother James. As the years passed, John, together with James the Lord's brother, learned to practice wise conciliation when they appeared before the civil magistrates. They found that a soft answer turns away wrath. They also learned to represent the church as a spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of mankind, rather than as the kingdom of heaven. They taught loving service rather than ruling power, kingdom, and king. When in temporary exile on Patmos, John wrote the book of Revelation, which you now have in greatly abridged and distorted form. This book of Revelation contains the surviving fragments of a great revelation, large portions of which were lost, other portions of which were removed, subsequent to John's writing. It is preserved only in fragmentary and adulterated form. John traveled much, labored incessantly, and after becoming bishop of the Asia churches, settled down at Ephesus. He directed his associate, Nathan, in the writing of the so-called Gospel According to John at Ephesus when he was 99 years old. Of all the 12 apostles, John Zebedee eventually became the outstanding theologian. He died a natural death at Ephesus in A.D. 103, when he was 101 years of age.
So, there you have it, Ichabod. The story of the Gospels, how they came about, who wrote them, who contributed, what the Gospel writers were trying to tell us and who they were speaking to. Now, we're going to continue with the study of the books of the Bible, beginning with Acts. But first, we're going to pause now, and we're going to discuss the story that is discussed fully and completely in the Gospels. We're going to talk about the greatest story ever told, the story of Jesus. Once we have completed that, we will then again pick up with the book of Acts, with a bit of a renewal from the Gospel of Luke, and then carry on through the books of the New Testament Bible all the way to Revelation. So, lots of interesting things about to happen. Stay with us. This is going to get really exciting. We'd like to thank the Urantia Fellowship for their sponsorship, and we'd like to thank the Cosmic Citizen for allowing God's Gumshoe to air under their banner. We hope that you'll watch the Cosmic Citizen on Saturdays at 10 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time, and join us next week on Sunday at 11 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time for The Story of Jesus, the greatest story ever told, comparing all of the books of the Bible with the academic understandings and with the perspective of our third voice, the Urantia Papers or the Urantia Book. Please invite your friends to join us and help us to promote this particular series. We'll see you next week. Thank you. Bye now.